Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greetings, Happy New Year, and welcome to Season 4 of Animal Instinct. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, also known as the Food Healer, and I'm totally thrilled to ring in the new year with my guest, crow expert John Marsliff, PhD. John is a professor of wildlife and science in the University of Washington. His research has been the focus of articles in the New York Times, National Geographic, Audubon, Boys Life, the Seattle Times, and National Wildlife. PBS's Nature featured his raven research in its production Ravens and his crow research in the film documentary A Murder of Crows. I've been asked many times to do a show on crows, and I'm really excited to start the season off with this topic, especially on National Bird Day. How lucky is that? Hi, John. Are you there?
I'm here. How are you, Celia?
I'm good. How are you? Happy New Year.
Thank you, and to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Like I said, everybody seems to be interested in crows these days. I've had probably 50 requests for this show, so I'm thrilled to have you on.
My pleasure.
So let's start out at the top. What birds are in the crow family, and are crows and ravens related?
Well, crows and ravens are closely related. They're in the same genus. It's called the genus Corvus. Mm-hmm. And overall, the group of what we kind of colloquially called crows, includes actually a diverse group of about 140 or 50 species. And these are things like the jays, like the common blue jay in the east, or scrub jay in the west, the nutcrackers, of course, the crows and ravens themselves, mm-hmm. but also things like magpies.
Wow. Oh, wow. I had no idea. And
it's
so,
quite a diverse group.
Yeah, it really is, and it's like a lot like the jays and all that. They seem like they're a pretty tough group too. Blue jays can be pretty mean at times.
They all do share that rather boisterous personality.
And so, how long, as far as we know through research, have crows really been around as crows?
Well, the whole group started evolving, let's say, about 20 million years ago and starting to split off into different ancestors that would have led to the crow or raven lineage. I think we can go back pretty easily about 7 or 8 million years ago and say that there were some really proto or ancestral crow types around. But only about the last 4 million years did really things we would recognize probably as a crow or a raven and the distinctiveness between those really evolve.
Hmm. And so what's a crow's normal lifespan?
It is extremely difficult to get the lifespan, you know, of a wild animal. The only way is if you mark it as a young animal that you know the exact age of and then catch it again or see it again decades later when it's old.
That's a good point.
We know from those kind of marked studies that crows and ravens of 10 to 20 years are not that uncommon. Mm-hmm. In captivity, there are reports of crows and ravens living up to 70 or 80 years.
Wow.
But those are hard to, you know, to really definitively verify.
Yeah, yeah. And what's the story on how they live? Like, do they mate for life, that kind of thing?
Well, all the different members of the crow group, they have slightly different social structures, but they all fundamentally do mate for life, and the pair bond between that mated male and female is really the cornerstone of any of their social groups. Now, whether young animals hang around with their parents and form extended family groups, which occurs in a lot of jays and some of the crows, or whether they just stay as a male-female partner, that's pretty variable. But we actually see the full range of social organization that we know about. We see the full range in the corvid group.
Wow. Wow, it's amazing. I watched your documentary last week of A Murder of Crows, and I've got to tell you, it was one of the most fascinating things I've ever seen in my life. I knew crows
were
smart.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Oh, my God, I had no idea. Like, I knew they were smart. I've read about them and stuff, but wow. I mean, I got to tell you. And there was one scene in particular that really, really stuck with me. I don't remember where it was, but there's a neighborhood where it's just overrun with crows, and there was a falconer who had trained his falcon to go after these crows and basically get them out of the garbage and everything. And he let the thing go, and it went after a crow, and it pinned her down, and then he got the crow, and she was unharmed, and let her go. And, like, the reaction from all the other crows when she flew back was, I've never seen anything like it. It was absolutely like she went back to safety. They all kind of ran to her and were like, what happened? What's going on? So, like, I have so many questions. I'm so sorry. I'm tongue-tied. They're so smart, but like to see them doing that, they actually have like really full communication, don't they?
They have a very complex communication language that we don't fully understand. But I think in this particular case, what really is happening there, it's not so much that the bird that was caught is going back and telling others, "Hey, this is a bad deal. Get away from this." Mm-hmm. But she will do that, or when he or she sees that situation again, that trapper, or maybe even that place. That's mm-hmm. what the trapper's hoping, is that by seeing that place, that bird will indicate, hey, this was a bad place. This is dangerous. When I was here last time, I almost got killed. They won't say that, but they'll just indicate danger, 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 I think is a better way to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And all the other crows that hear and see the action of that bird who's indicating danger, they come to mimic it and also say, danger, danger, here.
Mm-hmm.
And so the crow society learns through this indication by some experienced individuals that this is a bad place, we need to stay away, or this is a bad person, we need to stay away from them.
So in terms of their learning, I mean, they're so brilliant. I'm assuming a lot of this is instinct, but they seem to like really cognitively learn quite quickly. Is that true?
They learn incredibly quickly, and I mean, I would actually say that most animal behavior that we know about today,
mm-hmm.
it's very rare to have it be purely instinct. Almost all behaviors have some kind of genetically programmed component, what we might think of as instinct,
right.
And something that's learned from experience or from observation. And that's the cool thing with crows, and especially relevant to that bird getting caught by the falconer, is that they don't have to learn by just that direct experience. Sure, that animal that was caught by the hawk
mm-hmm.
won't forget it.
Yeah.
However, all the other crows that were in the area, that big group that saw it happen, they also won't forget it. So social animals, like a lot of the crows are,
mm-hmm.
they learn both by direct experience and by social learning or observation.
Okay. So it's similar to human beings in a sense.
Yeah, I think it's the same as what's going on in human beings. They are tuned into particular parts of the environment that we don't pay much attention to.
Mm-hmm.
We're tuned into particular parts that they don't pay so much attention to. But
true.
We do it fundamentally in the same way, probably even employing the same mechanisms in our brain to do it.
Wow. And do you know if a human brain and a crow brain are similar?
Well, the bird brain in general is built quite differently than the mammal brain.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are an awful lot of parts that are the same. They might be arranged a little differently.
Uh-huh.
But they've got the same fundamental parts that we do, a big forebrain that basically considers information that they're seeing or hearing or touching in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then other parts of the brain that help form associations between those sights and sounds and the outcome. You know, was it good? Was it bad?
Yeah.
Just like we do. And long-term memories that they can bring in to advance their feeling or experience in a given area at a particular time. And also emotional centers of their brain. Birds have emotional centers that are the same as humans have.
Wow.
And they can bring into a given sensory experience the emotion that's going on at that time. Are they fearful? Are they bold?
Mm-hmm.
Are they aggressive? Are they looking for a mate? Those sorts of emotional feelings charge the memories and experiences at a given place and a given time, just like in us.
Mm-hmm. And so how smart is your average crow?
Oh, I'd say smarter than about a three-year-old is probably one way to put it. They're certainly right up there with monkeys and apes
okay.
that have been tested. I think they're smarter than most dogs, and I've got three border collies, so
oh, wow.
I know smart dogs.
Yeah, you do.
And the crows can outsmart them at their particular specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one thing when we talk about intelligence, you have to talk about intelligent in what way.
Right.
And crows in particular are very smart at dealing with variability that humans put out in their environment and dealing with us.
Mm-hmm.
And dogs are really good at learning what we want them to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're both using the same sorts of strategies and parts of their brain to learn. And you might think that they're one is a lot smarter than the other, but I'd say they're probably pretty much on par with each other.
Right, like they know what they need to know kind of thing.
Perfectly said. They know what they need to know. Evolution has fashioned them to be able to gather that knowledge for millions of years.
Well, I got to tell you, when I was in college at BU, we had a psychology class, and there was this test that was done. I'm sure you know it. It's like the standard Crow-Raven test where it involves like a bell jar and a bottle and I think there was a piece of string and a chopstick and something in the bottle. And so we were put into teams and we had to figure out how to get everything out by only using the chopstick, basically. And so all of us failed miserably. None of us could figure out any of this. It was a fiasco. After about 45 minutes of trying this, he puts on this video of this crow who did it in, 3 minutes or something like this.
It
was the worst. So all of us just felt like really useless and just really stupid. And, you know, it was kind of like, thanks a lot, you know? But it was so unbelievable to see this. Or like on YouTube, these people that set up these like challenges for the birds, you know, and it's these long courses and they've got to pull this string and then they've got to jump over this and like they just get through it. It's so fast. It's amazing to me.
It really implies that the ability to do that implies you can schedule your activities. You know, you formulate a mental plan that you do this, then that, then this, then that. And that wasn't something we thought of animals being able to do at all. They kind of reacted to the moment, and that was it.
Yeah.
But crows have really shown us that they do link together long series of tasks to solve a problem. And the only way they could do that is if they understood, they had a mental image of what needed to be done first.
Yeah.
And then they did it.
Yeah.
If you just start doing things like you guys would have done in class, you would have done all these random things and maybe, you know, after an hour, you would have figured out one that worked. But when you just sit back and think about it and schedule out, okay, I got to do this and this and this, that's a very different sort of learning. And really, it's what we think of as being reasoned behavior or insight.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to tell you, that day, that crow was smarter than about 400 18-year-olds in Boston. So.
That's great.
It was amazing. And I mean, we just felt so stupid after watching this video. And then we were all, you know, just like, God, that bird's smart. So, yeah.
Put you in your place.
Very much so. And it was a real good hit for a bunch of freshmen, you know. It was pretty hardcore, actually.
Great.
So in terms of a crow's diet, do they kill or do they eat carrion or are they omnivores?
They're really omnivores. They will certainly kill small things, baby birds, small mice and frogs and things like that, snakes. They're quite effective predators, especially the bigger ravens. They can even kill larger birds, such as a grouse or maybe even a very young deer or something like
that.
Holy cow. So they can be predators, but they're really opportunists. And if they find something dead, they're glad to eat that.
Mm-hmm.
If they find something small and alive they can handle, they're glad to eat that.
Mm-hmm.
They eat a lot of fruits and other sorts of vegetable matter as well.
I mean, I'm surprised these birds don't cook. You know, they're just...
To our knowledge, they have not cooked.
Stay tuned. We'll find it.
Right.
All right.
That would be neat.
That would be amazing. And I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I'm sure if they could, they'd cook better than 3/4 of the people in New York City that don't know how to cook at all. So, you know, these guys are doing
good. We
know
they fish. As well as them, so they're right on the way.
That's amazing. All right. Well, we need to take a quick break for station identification. I'm speaking to John Marsliff, PhD, all about crows. Hang out with us for about a minute and a half, 2 minutes, and we'll be back to continue the conversation.
You are listening to Balloons by Jack Inslee.
Hello out there, it's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
Hi, this is Chad Pagano, former Army sniper, host of the Wild Game Domain, and you're listening to the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
And we are back. We're talking all about crows with expert John Marsloff. John, I wanted to know, I know this is a long question, but I'm fascinated with it. How do crows, or how have crows influenced humans?
Well, that is a long question. They've influenced us, really, I think, since we evolved, certainly for millennia. They've influenced us in terms of how we deal with the environment, how we bury our dead, what kinds of foods we hide and where we hide them, what our friends and neighbors would have done to keep food away from scavengers like crows back in the Pleistocene days.
Mm.
And more in modern terms, they influence our culture in many, many ways. Our language, we speak of, you know, having crow's feet when we get old around our eyes, or mm-hmm. going up to the crow's nest. Our music has often reflected the sounds that crows and ravens make, and a lot of our bands take names from crows and ravens, Crows or Black Crows, and same with our sports teams. So they've influenced our popular culture, our basic ecological behavior, and I really would say our evolutionary fabric.
It's amazing. And why do you think that is, that the crows and ravens have such a strong position in our history and folklore?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think they've got such a strong influence on us because of two reasons. And maybe the simplest way is to say, when you look at a crow or a raven, they look back at you. They look you right in the eye, and you have that kind of a connection, and you start thinking, wow, what's that animal doing?
Yeah.
And that's brought about by some of the tricks they'll play on us, stealing things from us, or sounding in such strange ways, even imitating our human voice. That gets your attention if you're in the woods and all of a sudden a crow comes up and says, hey, how are you doing?
Oh, my God, thank you for
you know,
saying
you think,
that.
Oh, my gosh, what am I dealing with here? And so this interaction is very personal, and it's also very close range because these animals evolve scavenging from predators like tigers and saber-toothed cats and mm-hmm. things, and they just came onto us as another sort of resource. Like a pack of wolves, a small group of people were out killing and gathering things that would be useful to the crow or raven.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a close association. And when you started interacting, it became really interesting and intriguing. And so you thought about them, and you worshipped, and kind of were a bit jealous of the sorts of things they could do, I'm sure.
Yeah. And it's funny, I was telling one of my good friends about doing this show, and she was all excited and said that she lives in Wisconsin, and she's been working in an office, and there's a crow that she sees every day that flies up to her window, and they look at each other, and she waves to him, you know, and he just kind of like hangs out and stares at her. And so she's at the point now where she's wondering if this bird could actually identify her. And, I mean, I'm assuming they can.
Well, they absolutely can identify individuals. We were curious about this here in my research because when we would typically study these birds, we'd have to catch them or we'd have to go to their nest to look in their babies and things like that. And we got the feeling pretty quickly that after you did something like that, they paid a lot more attention to you. So we actually did an experiment where we caught a few individuals. And when we caught them, we wore a particular mask, the face of a caveman in this case. And we tested then, do they respond to that mask or other masks in the future? And they respond very strongly and quite aggressively to us when we wear the mask that we wore when we originally captured the birds.
Like, will they attack you?
What's really intriguing to me is that most of the birds that respond, and this kind of gets back at your question about the falconer with the crow.
Yeah.
Most of the birds that respond are not the ones we caught. There are other birds that either saw us catch or learned from those we caught that we were bad and dangerous.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. So if you go out in that mask now, will you get attacked?
I'm going to be heading out in the next couple of weeks, and I can guarantee probably 8 out of every 10 crows I see are going to attack.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is going on 9 years now.
Holy cow.
I mean, they will not let loose of this guy that only caught 7 crows almost a decade ago.
Wow.
And they're on him as soon as he steps out the door. And it seems like every crow on our campus now where this occurs knows about this bad guy.
Wow.
And actually, I refer to it as they have basically a culture of hate that's developed about this particular person. And most of them had never experienced the caveman doing anything bad because he hasn't caught a bird for 8 years now. So
that's amazing.
It's remarkable to me.
Wow. Yeah, I'm just so blown away by this. It's like, you know, I've worked with horses, I've worked with dogs, I've worked with cats and like smaller animals, you know, and they can all be really smart, but I feel like comparatively we're talking a whole different level here, you know, especially with the interaction with human beings.
The interesting thing is that, as you say, these are interacting with humans, and these are wild animals that are doing it. It's not a domestic species that we have bred to be attentive to us for good reason.
Yeah.
Instead, this is a wild bird that's out doing its own thing, but then as soon as, you know, somebody crosses a line, a human crosses the line in some way, wow, you're marked, and they're on you for the rest of your life, probably. their life, certainly.
So if you have, like, a really horrible student, do you stick him in the mask and make him walk around the quad?
That's a good idea. I should start doing that.
That would be great.
So you'd like to study here? Yeah. Let's see. Can you get across campus? we haven't done that, no.
Oh, my God.
But it'd be a good one.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if someone was a different height and had that mask on, if they'd still react. I mean, I assume they would, you know.
Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. I didn't understand you. Yes, we've had all sorts of different people wear the mask.
Mm-hmm.
People from 7 to over 80 years old,
wow.
All different sizes and shapes and genders, different clothing and everything. It doesn't matter. If you've got the mask on, you're the bad guy.
It's so cool. I mean, it's just amazing to me. And the fact that they, you know, it seems like crows never forget.
Well, I mean, we don't know of other animals that hold memories this long.
Mm-hmm.
A wild animal. When psychologists talk of long-term memory, they're talking, hours. Something over a few hours is long-term memory. We're talking years. And they see this individual every once in a while, a couple times a year, and they recall this. And they also learn it anew, because every time the bad thing comes out, some birds sound the alarm, and all the others come in and participate in the alarming around that bad thing. So they're reinforcing the learning. It's not that they all have to remember for 9 years.
Yeah.
They can be refreshed whenever at least one of them, you know, says, hey, this is the guy, remember. And that's how new individuals learn, individuals that were born in the last few years that never experienced anything bad.
They learn
by participating in this group situation.
So when you were researching and studying them, I mean, what was it like? Like, did they get to know you? And was it different than researching other birds?
It's definitely different than researching other birds. I've done lots of work on songbirds and raptors as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they all do get to know you. And they get to know you as a potential threat, really.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with the kind of work we do where you're trying to watch the bird. I mean, we're not doing anything dangerous to them, but just kind of being there and always looking at them with binoculars or telescopes, they tend to take that as a bit of a threat.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, you know, what's this person? Why are they paying attention? And they do tend to be a little unnerved by that, but it's a whole different, you know, scale of response when you're talking about a golden eagle
mm-hmm.
that, might look your way when you're out there, versus a crow who won't do anything until you get within a few feet, and especially if you look at the crow, then they're off. So they're nuancing their response, keeping track of your actions in a very, very complicated way relative to things like eagles and pigeons, for example.
That's amazing to me, too. I would just because, you know, just the PR on the eagle alone, you would think that this would be like the PhD of birds. So to hear that crows or even can outsmart eagles is like, I mean, they just blow my mind. This just totally blows my mind. So for you, what impresses you the most about these birds?
Well, I think it's their adaptability, to be honest, more than anything. And that really comes back to their ability to innovate. And the ability to innovate is all driven by having a large brain, and especially a large forebrain that allows them to consider their actions even before they act, to learn from their actions and quickly modify their behavior to a given situation.
Wow.
And like we were saying with the different kinds of birds, eagles pretty much do the same thing. They will learn some different hunting techniques. They will hunt as a pair, a male and female eagle. But crows are innovating daily on how they go about living and exploiting their environment.
Wow.
And that, to me, is what's most fascinating, is that every day with a crow is different. And it's always you're learning something new, you're seeing something you hadn't seen before, and you just don't do that with a lot of other birds. They pretty much, they've been selected through evolution to do a particular task very well, like an eagle can see prey a mile away.
Wow.
And that works. But a crow has got to adjust all the time to be able to survive with us in our cities and places that are so active and dangerous for other animals. They've got to be innovative to survive, and they do.
Wow. This is so cool. I'm totally digging this interview. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, because I'm really loving every second of this. So I wanted to talk about, you've written a highly acclaimed book called Welcome to Suburbia. And I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit, because I'm also fascinated about this topic, too.
Sure. That's a new book just out. And in Welcome to Suburbia, I look at a lot of our research we've done on other species in addition to the crow and the songbirds that live around us, and really start with the hopeful kind of premise that what we discovered when we started counting birds in different environments was that we found a greater diversity, a richer bird community in and around our subdivisions than we did, of course, in the downtowns of our cities, but also more diverse in our subdivisions than in national parks and places like that.
Wow.
And so we were left with this, wondering, what's going on? This is supposed to be bad for biodiversity. And in fact, the way we develop some areas, if we do it lightly and we do it appropriately, we can generate incredible diversity. And so putting a little bit different spin on the human use of our environment, which we usually think of as very destructive, and it is. I'm not downplaying that. It's very destructive in many ways. But it can be constructive. We can create species. We can create incredible communities of animals that live right around us. And if we tolerate them and learn to enjoy and wonder about them, we can also build a broader conservation ethic and use that to conserve animals in some of these remote places, the kinds of animals that don't get along with us very well.
I mean, like I said, I live in Brooklyn, and I've been in the same place for 11 years, and I've really noticed in like the past 6 or 7 years that there's far less birds and far less species than there were around than when I first moved in. I mean, even the blue jays, like there are no blue jays. I haven't seen any in about 2 years. Meanwhile, my dad is at a place up in the suburbs, and I go up there all the time, and it's like bird mania. And the amount of species and everything that's up there is so unbelievably diverse. And it fascinates me, because I'm wondering if where I am, the environment is no good, so these birds are leaving and migrating up to the suburbs, or if they're dying off in the city from God knows what reasons and are just doing better in the suburbs. You know, it's a really funny thing.
Yeah, and it's some of both is what we've discovered. I mean, some birds, those that don't tolerate us, they do move. They disperse, and they end up in places where their needs are met. And often those are birds that need more forested or open areas away from people, what we call avoiders. And then there's these other two groups, exploiters and adapters, that can tolerate and deal with us. But if if pavement gets to occupy too much of the environment, basically, if our technology takes over more than 40, 50, 60% of the environment, those very few species can tolerate that. And I think that's what happens in our more built-up cities, is that we finally just run out of this rich mix of habitats that we have in the suburbs. Some built, some unbuilt, some developed, some undeveloped, openings, forested areas, new plantings of shrubs and native species. And you get all that mix in a suburb that, you know, is somewhere between 40 and 60% developed.
Yeah.
And that's where diversity peaks. And it's because there's a lot of habitat diversity there. And supplements. Does your father put out a bird feeder, for example?
Sadly, not consistently enough for it to be effective. But, you know, for people that do, that, yeah, that's like the bar in town, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, certainly some of his neighbors do, and they are. That's bolstering an awful lot of the diversity that we see in our subdivisions.
Well, it's nice to see that, you know, just doing something that simple can really, really help. So that's important.
Yeah, there's other simple, there's some really simple things that we can do. And the first is, you know, if you do live in the suburbs and you've got an extensive lawn, shave it back. Don't have so much lawn area. Plant some more shrubs and other ground covers, not just turf. That diversity of the landscape is key for not only birds but also frogs and turtles and things like that. So keeping things diverse, adding food, water, those all help. Making sure if you've got windows that have big open panes of glass, that you make those visible to birds because they don't see them, and that's really that's the second largest source of mortality for birds
really?
In our neighborhood. Yeah. Half a billion a year in the U.S. are killed by running into windows.
No way. Really?
Yep. And you can get, again, fairly simple thing, little UV reflective stickers and put on your windows. Birds can see those and avoid the window. And, of course, the biggest killer of birds is the domestic cat that's let outside and allowed to roam free. And those guys kill, you know, probably 2 to 4 billion birds a year in the U.S. And so the most important thing that we can do is to reduce that. Keep your cats inside or have them on leashes or other enclosed areas outside. And especially if you do feed birds, don't let your cat outside. And I was surprised in Seattle. We did a survey a few years ago, and about 60% of the people that feed birds also let cats out.
Oh, so great.
that's a bad thing. And that's an easy... It should be an easy lesson to learn. And what I try to do with Welcome to Suburbia is to get people to understand that, you know, this is an ecosystem that we live in.
Yeah.
Your neighborhood is. The ecosystem isn't something that's only in the Amazon.
Yeah.
You are part of an urban ecosystem where you live, and your actions do matter, and they affect the other members of our community, the birds and frogs and things like that. And you can learn and wonder at those. They're fascinating interactions. Even if it's a crow solving a puzzle in your yard, those are interesting, and they're windows to learn about the other members of your community that live around you. And when you start seeing that, you start seeing your land not as just an investment, not something you're just, you know, going to retire on, but as really a full community, and your role in it is very important, and it's very apparent as you look around.
So in terms of people, I mean, you know, as we know, there's a lot of problems going on right now with the neonicotinoids and the poisons that are being used. They're killing off, you know, the bees and butterflies and things like this. I'm assuming they're as bad for birds as well?
They are, and the way they get into the bird system is primarily by first poisoning things like rodents, which then are eaten by predators, hawks and owls and things like that. That's the biggest direct influence of those poisons. And that is a big factor. But when you stack up all the sources of mortality for birds, if you could deal with cats and you could deal with windows, the others are so minor relative to those two big ones. That, I mean, I think we should do everything we can.
Yeah.
But if, you know, for every 10 people that would keep a cat inside instead of outside, boy, that goes a long way relative to reducing some of these other threats. But it's a full system, and I guess the way to think of it is that if you want to be live a little more ecologically conscious mm-hmm. on your land. There's a menu to start working on here. There's a lot of things you can do. There's something for everybody to be able to do. And some might do the whole thing, some might do one or two things, but it's all important. And we can all do a little bit, and together that adds up to a large effect over a big part of Earth that we live on and a lot of animals that are able to live with us if we just live a little more kindly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. That's nice. And so could you tell us how listeners can find out more about crows and about all your work? Because your work is amazing. I mean, everything I've seen, everything I've read that you've written that I've up to this point, P.S., I'm going to read all of it now, has been just amazing and totally fascinating and super interesting, too, which is why I like it, because sometimes this kind of stuff gets a little dry, but, like, you're really yeah. personable. It's wonderful. So how can we turn our listeners on to you?
Well, thank you very much. I think the easiest way to find out about some of this sort of information, I have a website that is my research lab's website, and there are links there to various talks and books, but there are also links to the primary literature. And as people learn more and get interested in things, I also encourage you to dig more into the real science behind it, because mm-hmm. It's fun to kind of see, you know, what in the heck did these guys really do and how'd they do that? And you can get that from digging into some of those science papers. And in all of my books, I try to include quite a lot of scientific literature that's in an appendix or a bibliography in the back mm-hmm. that people, again, can dig into and learn more on their own, because the information's out there. You need a guide to kind of point in those areas. And that's what I try to do with that, because there is, as you say, an awful lot of dry stuff to weed through. And it's hard to pick out the interesting things, but it's out there, and I would encourage people to go there and then follow what you find interesting. If you're interested in language of crows, boy, there's a whole bunch you can do there to understand what we know. You can go to websites like the Cornell University website mm-hmm. that has calls on it, and listen to them yourself and see what kind of sounds they make under different situations. So a lot of self-directed learning that can be done with these birds, because they are there. They're visible. You don't have to go far away to find one to observe and wonder about.
And, I mean, if any of you all are into documentaries, make sure you do Google A Murder of Crows. It's amazing. I was blown away by this documentary. It kind of freaked me out a couple of times just because they're so smart. It was like, turn it off. But it truly opened my eyes as to how incredibly brilliant these birds are. And this whole species is just amazing. So sadly, we are running out of time, but thank you so much for taking the time and talking to us and teaching us a little bit more about crows. I'm a huge fan now, buddy. You have rendered me speechless, which never happens, so congratulate yourself.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad your enthusiasm is contagious, and I hope your listeners will take it and run with it and help teach me a bit more about these animals as well.
I'll tell you, anytime you need some help, give me a call. I would love to hang out with you for a day or two and just see what you guys do. I think it'd be fascinating.
You got it.
Yay. So thank you so much, Professor John Marsloff, Heritage Radio Network. All of you listeners, without you guys, this wouldn't be possible. Let's start off this year with a bang and have a really happy one. I'll see you all next week. Take care.
Theme music for Animal Instinct has been provided by the Ranch Hands. The song is called Never Coming Home.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.